Good afternoon. Could I welcome everybody here to the third Clifford Barclay Enterprise Lecture? As many of you, I'm sure, know, Clifford Barclay was a very distinguished accountant and businessman who was a governor and a benefactor of the London School of Economics for more than 20 years, until his death almost exactly 3 years ago, at the age of 84. This annual lecture is supported by the Barclay family, and I'm very pleased indeed to see Evelyn Barclay, who was Clifford Barclay's widow, who's here this evening, as well as their children, Stephen and Jill, and their respective spouses. And we're also delighted that in what has now become a rather excellent family tradition as far as the school is concerned, that Stephen has recently accepted an invitation to become a governor of the school. So we look forward to many years yet of valuable contribution from the Barclay family. This evening's lecture will be delivered by Professor Ian Angel and is intriguingly entitled, I Have Seen the Future and It Works. He tells me, and I was as unfamiliar with the source of the title as I'm sure many of you are, though some smart aleck here may of course be familiar with the origin of the quotation, but please keep it to yourself. The words, I have seen the future and it works, were apparently spoken by a gentleman called Lincoln Steffens on visiting Moscow in 1919 at the birth of the Soviet Union, as it then was. Professor Angel has asked me to tell you this because he doesn't want you to lose sight of what he calls the irony as his talk progresses. Now, so far as Professor Angel is concerned, he has a background in mathematics, and he has held the chair of information systems here at the LSE since 1986. His early work was in the field of computer graphics, and in the last 10 years or so, he has concentrated on strategic information systems, computers and risk, and on organizational and national IT policies. And I'm anticipating that we shall hear a thought-provoking and possibly even, dare I say it, controversial lecture. And so without more ado, and with great pleasure, may I invite Professor Angel to deliver the third Clifford Barclay Memorial Lecture.
Thank you, Tony, and good evening, everyone. I have seen the future, and it works. I may not like it, you may not like it, but it works. The media really don't like it. Just open any newspaper or switch on the radio and television, and you'll find journalists worldwide bemoaning a crisis of confidence in the social, political, and economic institutions. For they know we're on the verge of an information revolution that is taking us out of the machine age into who knows what. There's a deep feeling that it's all coming to an end. Many of these commentators are deeply pessimistic. They see only chaos ahead. They see chaos because they are interpreting the events in terms of the very control structures and the very institutions that are failing. They are reflecting an increasingly uncertain tomorrow in the distorting mirror of yesterday's defunct certainties. They want the world to be the way it ought to be. Just consider the British press and politicians who keep asking themselves and us interminably, where is the feel-good factor? Even when the numbers look good, with the economy growing, with low inflation, unemployment falling, the country is still miserable. A malaise has contaminated the national consciousness. See, the British people aren't stupid. They know that the elite few have never lost the feel-good factor. But as for the majority of our society, any society, they know that the feel-good factor has gone forever, and they know there is nothing that anyone can do about it. For history is the natural selection of accidents, and our world today is full of accidents just waiting to happen. They will either catapult communities into a new prosperity, or they will relegate them to poverty, obscurity, and extinction. The very natures of work, of institutions, of society, and even of capitalism itself are mutating. These mutations are confronting each other in a political power vacuum left by the fall of communism on one hand, but also the increasing impotence of liberal democracy, as the utopia that was promised by science and technology has turned into a nightmare for the common man. Overpopulation, mass migration, global plagues, unemployment, poverty, pollution, etc., etc., determine that the world is full of frightened people. This is not the world for the timid. None but the brave will win in this new world. This is a world where the socio-economic certainties of the 20th century are collapsing, where everything is changing, and I really do mean everything, politics, economics, business, society as a whole. And I really do mean change, not the nice, tidy change that management gurus tell you in their change management seminars, not a nice, tidy transition, but a severe and a total dislocation with the past. One thing is certain. The masses will not win in the natural selection for dominance of an increasingly elitist world. Naturally, the politicians don't like it. For the past two centuries, the values of the weak prevailed because the strong have taken them over as devices of leadership. But no longer. The politicians may promise, but now the markets decide. I may not like it. You may not like it. The masses certainly won't like it. But I have seen the future, and it works. For some. But why is this all happening now? The answer is quite simple. A new order is being forced upon an unsuspecting world by advances in telecommunications. The future is being born in the so-called information superhighways. Very soon, these electronic telecommunication networks, the infobarns of cyberspace, covering the world via cable and satellite, will enable everyone, well, everyone who can afford it, everyone in the world to talk to everyone else. Global commerce will force through the construction of these multimedia highways, and anyone bypassed by the highway faces ruin. We are entering an elite cosmopolitan age. Information technology, together with speedy international travel, is changing the whole nature of political governance and its relationship to commerce. It's changing commerce itself. Whether we like it or not, the world we know is changing. It may even be moving into reverse. We may be entering a new dark age. But this is not a time for despair, quite the opposite. It's a time of great opportunity, but only for the few. Today's technologies have unleashed unstoppable global economic forces, which are empowering adolescent forms of new barbarism. A new order is created, it's emerging, through the heroic actions of opportunistic individuals, opportunistic organizations, the new barbarians. But now there are coming new barbarians, cynics, experimenters, conquerors, a union of spiritual superiority with well-being and an excess of strength. Another type of barbarian who comes from the heights. A species of conquering and ruling natures in search of material to mold. Prometheus was this kind of barbarian. The new barbarians come from the margins. They are imaginative outsiders, these individuals and organizations. They ignore tribal loyalties. They know that there are enormous opportunities out there for those who have the vigor and the vitality, the nerve to break free of the limitations of tribal boundaries that have been drawn in the past. These are the people who have the vision to redraw their own borders, to redraw their own futures. I have seen the future in this new barbarian hypothesis. It's a social mechanism whereby opportunists sweep away old moribund institutions, not in anarchy and chaos, but with new ideas, new moralities, new power structures, subsequently laying the foundations of a new institutions, a new order. You see, information technology has liberated the elite barbarian few from the physical limitations of three-dimensional space. It has freed them from the constraint, the mindset, and the moralities of the collective. And these, you see, are firmly based in three space. It has set the individual free to roam the higher dimensions of this cyberspace. And this new freedom will have astounding implications for anyone who can grasp its potential. A line is being drawn between the information rich and the information poor, and consequently between the rich and the poor. New barbarian employers are using new technology to redefine totally the very nature of work. The network portable computer and the mobile phone are turning office workers into teleworkers. Companies can slash both their office overheads and staff numbers. And company functions can be outsourced to freelancers on a pay-as-you-need basis. A new type of worker is appearing, the self-employed portfolio worker, working for a number of different companies, being paid on piece rate, and only as and when used. See, what barbarian employers are doing are they are pushing the responsibility for conforming to the legal rights of the workforce and their financial obligations down onto these subcontractors. And in that way, they're avoiding all liability. Those who are lucky enough to be in work will have to work harder as teleworkers. They will work for more hours per week, for less pay, in far less secure jobs. The new barbarian company will use fewer workers to cover the same workload. In Britain, millions of workers commute to work every week. Over a third of these jobs can be teleworked, either wholly or in part. And these jobs can be transferred anywhere. They will move from high-cost areas to low-cost areas. For example, British Airways has a telesales center in Ulster, which serves Wales and the Midlands. British Telecom's directory inquiries for South London is based in Portadown, Northern Ireland. See, jobs that support the workplace in the machine age are an endangered species in the information age. Tea ladies, canteen staff, security men, cleaners, receptionists, electricians, carpenters, janitors, they're all going to go. The end of commuting is in sight, and so is the end of the public transport union. We are seeing the successful office of the future being changed into a radically different animal, the virtual office. Charles Handy predicts that the office of the future will be structured like a club, where most of the space is allocated not to work, but to socialize. This is where valued employees meet other valued employees as part of organizational bonding. The working parts of the office will be linked via the telephone to the cars, to the home of the workers. All the data that's required for conducting business can be communicated back and forth between the employee's portable computer and a file store. Should the workers require some office space now and again for the odd meeting, then buildings can be timeshared. On arrival, workers will be given a key to the hot office, which is any office. It needn't even be the same on each visit. There is no need even for the physical location of that office to be fixed, or even owned by the company. An all-knowing information system will establish the exact location of each and every employee, and messages for a given individual will be delivered directly to him, no matter where he is in the building, no matter where he is in the world, just in time. Office space will be hired on short time scales, perhaps even just a few hours. For the office, the desk is where the employee plugs in to the network. It can be anywhere. Just in timeshare, information systems will keep track of everything. So we're already seeing the first signs of this trend with hotels, railway stations, airports supplying temporary office space. Post offices in many rural areas are becoming telecenters. And it's not just the offices that are being affected. A company can also resite its factories, its headquarters, and the teleworkers in the sticks. It can just as easily move abroad to countries with less stringent legal requirements and less stringent employment regulations. This is why Siemens have moved its new factory to the UK. ICL runs its mainframe helpline from Pune in India. Even the British Home Office at one time was seriously considering subcontracting a large but a straightforward data entry job to the Philippines. See, these innovative moves are completely undermining the paradigm that land is wealth. Companies will simply desert a factory or an office if the demands of the workforce are excessive. This is what Timex did when it abandons its Dundee site. They didn't own the site, it was leased from the local authority. They sent helicopters in to take out the equipment that they needed, they just junked the rest. In the information age, the value of the office, of the factory real estate, is going to enter freefall, as the demand for space will become a small fraction of the supply. There are going to be some very bad times ahead for the owners of office blocks. New barbarian organizations do not get tied into long-term office leases. They know there are going to be bargains galore around the corner. And no longer tied to a single location, these barbarians are free to ring the death knell of organized labor and the dinosaur trade unions. So we can see two major forces that are rapidly emerging in this new order: the globalization of organization and their mobilization. Individuals and companies are setting up large transnational networks which can move rapidly, unhindered by national boundaries and barriers. The commercial enterprise of the future will be truly global. It will relocate physically or electronically to where the profit is greatest and the regulation least. The umbilical cords have been cut. The global company no longer feels the need to support the nation and the national aspirations of its birth. Recently, this new business paradigm was expressed most forcibly by Akio Morita, head of Sony, when he announced that Sony was a global company, not a Japanese company. It caused absolute uproar back home in Japan. But paradoxically, globalization is resulting in a trend towards localization. Companies are setting themselves up within virtual enterprises at the hub of loosely knit alliances of local companies. They're all linked together by global networks, both human and electronic. These companies assemble to take advantage of a temporary business opportunity, and then they separate, searching for the next major deal. Now, apart from local products, the local companies will also deliver local expertise and access to home markets for products produced from the wider alliance. Each virtual enterprise will be project-based and developed around complex information systems. In fact, the information system is the organization. There's nothing else there. Companies outside such computer-linked organizations have no future. I've seen the future. The very presence of barbarian enterprises can strengthen national economies, but they can just as easily destroy them. Just think of George Soros. Global enterprises do not identify with any particular country, and they will walk away from it just as easily as they enter. Benjamin Franklin recognized this truth 2 centuries ago. He said, "Merchants have no country. The mere spot on which they stand does not constitute so strong an attachment as that from which they draw their gain." Now companies must think globally because they can communicate globally and because their shareholders, their executive, and their employees are spread out across the globe. International trading now includes new forms of barter and exchange. Money, which is merely the means of facilitating economic transactions, has itself become electronic information. And what constitutes money can no longer be monopolized by national governments. As Hayek said, the causes of waves of unemployment is not capitalism, but governments denying enterprise the right to produce good money. Hayek's vision of the denationalization of money is becoming a reality. And these trends inevitably lower the transaction costs of money, and it makes taxation of the profits and the regulation of the process almost impossible. Now, this is a real competitive advantage for any virtual enterprise with a movable center of gravity. And also, it is an opportunity for those merchant new barbarians who are willing to trade their expertise in this electronic marketplace. So what does this actually mean for the worker? Peter Drucker says that humanity is polarizing into 2 employment categories: the intellectual, cultural, and business elite. These are the mobile and independent knowledge workers. These are the potential barbarians. And the rest, the immobile and the dependent service workers. We can call them the peasants. In a similar vein, Robert Reich believes that information age, there will be 3 categories. Symbolic analytic services, these are the knowledge workers. But what they do is they are problem identifiers, problem solvers, and those individuals who can broker between the two. Then we have in-person service workers, and finally, routine production workers. The latter two groups roughly correspond to Drucker's service workers. Now, I include within the symbolic analysts people like sports stars, pop singers, TV film celebrities, any unique talent that sells itself across the telecommunications media. And I would also add 2 further categories, security and the underclass, but more of that later. A company cannot survive without its knowledge workers, but its routine production jobs can be replaced by robots, or they can be exported anywhere in the world. Wages in this sector are already beginning to converge on third world levels. Companies large and small are on the move. For example, British Polythene Industries, a small company, is to close its factory at Telford with a loss of 150 jobs, and they are switching to China. BPI's payroll bill will be cut by 90%. Nestle has moved jobs from Scotland to France. Hoover have moved from France to Scotland. The French authorities have been attempting to attract textile companies from Nottingham. See, the European Union are frantically talking about legislating against such social dumping. And this social dumping is having an effect of dragging down wages in the in-person service worker sector, a sector which is itself becoming increasingly automated. In Britain, 150,000 bank workers have lost their jobs in the last decade simply because of new technology. Inevitably, the slow redistribution of wealth that has occurred over the last centuries is now being reversed, and it's being reversed rapidly. Societies are stratifying. New elites, new barbarian elites are appearing. The future is inequality. At the very bottom of the heap, Western societies are already witnessing the emergence of a rapidly expanding underclass. Furthermore, there is a growing realization that each service worker is a net loss, both to the state and to the company. They cost far more than they generate. Service workers will now be expected to add far more value to the company, unlike in the past when service work meant just turning up. Companies will be reducing the wages and the staffing levels of service workers. It's no accident that most Western companies are presently instigating major downsizing, outsourcing, and delayering programs. Now we can see that the knowledge workers are the real generators of wealth. The knowledge workers have always been the real generators of wealth, but now they realize it. The income of these owners of intellectual and financial wealth will increase substantially, and they will be made welcome anywhere in the world. More so, in an attempt at right-sizing, both companies and countries will pay a premium to attract knowledge workers and to keep them. From October 1994, entrepreneurial investors with £1 million at their disposal could bypass the usual entry rules into the UK. But Britain was very slow off the mark, with the added embarrassment that none of the global rich actually want to come here. In the USA, there is a fast-track immigration policy whereby businessmen and women with $1 million at their disposal and who are willing to employ 10 local people are allowed in. 600 millionaires moved to the USA in 1993. It's only a matter of time before intellectual capital, and such as scientific and technological expertise, will be included on the balance sheet. This is happening against a background of an exploding world population, particularly in the third world. To combat inevitable mass migrations, state barriers will be thrown up everywhere to keep out alien service workers, because each state has a surplus of its own to support. If you're a knowledge worker, it doesn't matter what your age, what your sex, what your race, what your religion. If you've got it, they will drag you off the plains. But if you're a service worker, nobody wants to know. It's already happening. In California, Proposition 187 intends to bar nearly 2 million illegal immigrants from schools, welfare services, and all but emergency health care. How long will it be before there are differential rights for differentiated citizens, identified in the database and policed by smart cards? How long will it be that the notion of human rights will look as ridiculous as the divine right of kings? Civil liberties groups are showing themselves totally out of touch with the information age when they oppose what they see as the state forcing whole populations to carry identity cards. There will be no force. It won't be a question of opting out. Only valued members of society will be invited to opt in. No card, no benefits, no card, no rights. Now, at a time when their skills are in increasing demand by global companies. Knowledge workers are feeling more and more undervalued and betrayed by the nation state. Exile no longer holds any terrors, and it's inevitable that predatory global networks would drive loyalty to the state in a steep decline among the swelling number of economic mercenaries, barbarian economic mercenaries. Loyalty to the self and other lateral loyalties are going to replace loyalty to the nation state. Now the barbarian chooses to give his loyalty freely and voluntarily. Loyalty is no longer an accident of birth. It is individual, not tribal. It is contractual and not judicial. It is made consciously on the basis of unashamed, rational self-interest, but only for the knowledge worker. At the same time, global enterprises are demanding loyalty of their employees, and they're demanding it's being transferred from the state to the company. But will they get it? The situation is possibly more complex because there's an increased reliance of companies on their symbolic analysts, the owners of intellectual equity. See, we are witnessing an intensifying power struggle between the symbolic analysts, who are the owners of the financial symbolic equity, and the owners of the companies themselves. And this is going to change fundamentally the nature of capitalism itself. This battle is likely to be at least as significant as that between the landowners and the industrialists in the early part of the 19th century that was brought to a head with the repeal of the Corn Laws, and that was formative of today's capitalism. You see, the battle's already started. When Jürgen Klinsmann left Tottenham Hotspur, Spurs shares dropped by 10%. Investor power forced Maurice Sarchi out of the advertising company that he founded because of poor stock market performance. What did he do? He formed a new company, and it was joined by senior analysts from Sarchi & Sarchi. And he took with him some major clients from his old company. So the old company, the low share price, fell even lower. And that's not at all what investor power expected. The symbolic analysts now have muscle. Financial equity is going to find they're going to have some real problems. So we are rapidly approaching a situation where, in order to attract the elite with their knowledge and their money, which will enliven the economy, the elite group will be expected to pay less tax and not more. The great majority of companies, of governments, are lowering top tax rates in line with declining global levels. For example, top income tax rates fell on average 16.5% between 1975 and 1989. This is Jeff Mulligan's figure, who works for Demos, you know, the left lobe think tank. The main producers and repositories of wealth, the multinational companies, have increasingly been able to adjust their accounts and the prices of their international transactions so that their profits are declared in low tax countries while they continue to operate in high tax ones. 60% of the world's private banking is held in trust in offshore tax havens. Through its secrecy laws and minimal regulation, Grand Cayman has become the fifth largest banking center in the world, with 500 banks, and this year $600 billion are going to pass through an island which is 20 miles long and 3 miles wide. Very soon, companies will be negotiating preferential tax deals, not only for themselves, but also for the chosen elite employees. If they want you, you get a tax break. A major growth market will be the serving of global information flows for the mobile rich. Anywhere, anytime, anyhow. And all the time, the disposable income for most of society will be drastically reduced. And worse, when Leona Helmsley, my heroine, said, "Only the little people pay taxes," She was actually making a prediction, although she didn't realize it. The power in global economic forces means that the tax burden is irrevocably moving onto the shoulders of the immobile and away from income onto expenditure. Now, this goes counter to every notion of social justice that has been prevalent in the last 200 years. Inevitably, in this transition, we can expect massive civil unrest. It's already started. Just look across the channel. As the peasants are protesting in Paris, see, I've caught the Neil Kinnock disease alliteration. As the peasants are protesting in Paris, the gnomes of London are profiting. Or should I say, the new barbarians of London are profiting. The results of these forces is a corrosion of national sovereignty. Everywhere the nation state is in retreat. All the while, citizens are losing their faith in the nation state, seeing it as a peculiarly 20th century phenomenon that supports the profligate and penalizes the thrifty. See, the state is failing to deliver its side of the Faustian pact, where the individual submits to the legitimate violence of the state in return for protection and security. Today's trend towards the growing power of knowledge workers is totally undermining the centralized power of state machinery. Globalization has shown the James Bond myth to be false. The idea that the state is good and global corporations, Spectre, are bad, is blatant propaganda on behalf of the nation state. And James Bond, who is the patron saint of civil servants, is now being seen as just another dirty old man. The nation state is based on the collectivist doctrine that we are all equal in that we are all property of the state, or rather of the leaders of the state, and that the state can dispose of its property as it sees fit. But new barbarians call this social injustice, for there is no justice in equality. To them, all taxation is theft. It's just extortion. It is the state obtaining money with menaces. The new barbarians say with derision that the common good isn't good, it is merely common. The very nature of the nation state itself is mutating. Increasingly, it will have to behave as merely another form of commercial enterprise, the corporation state. And it will have to be run like a corporation. See, that the roles of governments and organizations are converging was unconsciously highlighted by The Guardian of December the 10th, 1993. You gather from my political position, I don't normally read The Guardian. It was brought to my attention by a student. See, the headline said, they asked the question, what's the difference between Zambia and Goldman Sachs? The answer, one is an African country that makes $2.2 billion a year and shares it among 25 million people. The other is an investment bank that makes $2.6 billion a year and shares it between 161 people. Fair enough, it said in big, bold letters. You see, the bleeding heart liberals of The Guardian hemorrhage at what they see as gross unfairness, and they make snide comments about Goldman Sachs. They call it unfairness, but it's not. See, they fail to see that the symbolic analysts of Goldman Sachs earned that money. Yes, they earned it. They earned it fairly, working in cyberspace, and they intend to keep it. To the new barbarians, this call for fairness is the mere whinging of failures and parasites. They say it's time to rid ourselves of this backward-looking idea that work involves physical effort. Of course labor is needed, but there is a world full of laborers out there. It is that rare commodity, human intellect, which is the stuff of work in tomorrow's world. See, the new barbarians say that politicians really must stop saying Nanny knows best and playing to the sentimentality of the herd. Governments, like all other organizations, will have to survive economically on the efforts of the elite few. And no nation state has an automatic right to exist. If the state can convince the commercially attractive elite of knowledge workers and local entrepreneurial companies to stay, then we have a virtuous circle of success. For then, migrating global players and their wealth will be attracted into the country. However, if the state maintains a greedy collectivist and populist stance under the defunct motto, power to the people, then the entrepreneurial and knowledge elite will simply move on to more lucrative and agreeable climes. And in the long term, they will leave that country economically unviable, composed solely of unproductive masses, sliding inevitably into a vicious circle of decline. The Marxist myth that labor creates wealth is going to be buried once and for all. The role of the corporation state in the new order is to produce the right people with the right knowledge and expertise as the raw material for global companies, to service these companies and to provide them with an efficient infrastructure, a minimally regulated market, and a secure, stable, and comfortable environment. If the state cannot produce top quality people product in sufficient quantities, then it has to buy them from abroad. Each state must view education not as the right of every citizen, distributed arbitrarily, but as an investment on which it must expect a return. They have to invest in the elite, not the mediocre. They have to invest in success and not failure. In Britain, the universities, striving to create the ideal herd animal, which is there for the good of the state, are degenerating into seventh form colleges and polyversities. Many of the country's gullible young intellectual elite are sacrificing themselves on the altar of mediocrity in a national suicide pact called the Common Good. But the young barbarians know that the British university system, the very epitome of institutionalized mediocrity, is finished. They won't put up with a third-rate national education system when they can find the very best in the world on the superhighway. In 50 years' time, there's only going to be one university in Britain, and that's the Open University. At the same time, politicians, both knaves and the naive, are pandering to the masses. They incant the abracadabra words, training in new technology, to conjure up new jobs for the huge number of soon-to-be unemployed. If only it was that simple. When will these politicians ever learn that technology is the problem and not the solution? And in case you're wondering, I wrote this bit of the talk before Tony Blair made his pathetic Henry V impersonation at last week's Labour Party conference. Now, these out-of-touch politicians make a direct comparison between the information revolution and the industrial revolution. The industrial revolution took over 50 years to sort itself out in the UK. And even then, the social conditions of the workers were far from ideal. But that revolution merely changed one form of physical labor, the agricultural, for another in the factories. The information revolution is going to need intellectual muscle. Do the people who held factory or low-grade office and retail jobs have what it takes for the information age? I doubt it very much. But the jury is out, and the very best I can expect is a couple of lost generations. As far as the global enterprises are concerned, democracy is an anachronism. It's an artifact of the machine age, an ideology from the time when the masses were needed, but it will soon mutate into an irrelevancy. Democracy is power fixed in the tribe. It is basically a single platform, that of the virtue of tribal moralities. In the information age, governments chosen by the majority are governments chosen by losers. The will of the people, voting for full employment, a minimum wage, and fair taxation, is merely the turkeys voting for Christmas. The politics of envy is suicide. Democracy will degenerate into being merely the means of governing the immobile and the dependent service worker. That the citizens elect their slave masters makes their democracy slavery nonetheless. Witness the behavior of British ministers in the Matrix Churchill scandal. So you can see how little they value individual freedoms compared to their own interests, or as they would have it, national interests. The vast majority of people will have no choice other than to be slaves. But the new barbarians are free, and they will profit from the products of this slavery. A large population, particularly an uneducated and aging population, is now a liability. It has become the major problem facing all Western governments. The masses themselves will put employment and economic well-being before the dubious privilege of electing powerless representatives. And as George Orwell anticipated, a Saturday night lottery will soften the blow. And with the massive loss of jobs comes a triple whammy for governments: lower income tax revenues, increased social security payouts, and the need to support deprived areas financially. Because of the need to employ local masses, politicians have to find ways of attracting global employers to partner local companies. And to keep them attracted, governments will have no choice other than to acquiesce to the will of global enterprises. Consequently, not only will state be pitted against state, but area against area, town against town, suburb against suburb. Each state will permit entry to holders of company type, UN-style passports. Tax credits, tax holidays, and reduced regulation aimed at attracting in employers will be the name of the game everywhere. Already we're seeing this. Different states in Europe have embarked on regulatory arbitrage to tempt financial sector companies away from what they laughingly call their European partners. Any area with independent aspirations will use economic weapons against its neighbors and distance itself from legislative oppression. As Daniel Bell so eloquently put it 20 years ago, the nation state is too small for the big things and too big for the small things. The clamor for independence from Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland under the umbrella of the European Union will soon become deafening. But most of the noise will come from England, particularly the soon-to-become independence-minded home counties. Some futurologists expect that early in the next century, the number of states in the United Nations will increase from its present number of 184 to over 1,000. One inevitable consequence of the global trade will be the rise of the new city-state at the hub of an electronic and transport network. The non-democratic model of Hong Kong is an exemplar, only that city doesn't realize it yet. Singapore, too, under the enlightened rule of Lee Kuan Yew, is a useful model. What European city will be the first to break ranks with the nation-state mentality, holding back progress? A number of European cities are going to make the leap. Liechtenstein has already started, so has Monaco, Luxembourg. Let's not forget Venice, Perhaps it can rediscover former glories. It's only a matter of time before Lisbon jumps. It does have the singular example of attracting the Gulbenkian wealth earlier this century. The corporation of the City of London, too, has enormous potential. It could be revitalized. However, the dead hand of the Mother of Parliaments, the sleaze machine of Westminster, is going to make it far more difficult. Move governments to Birmingham and then London can succeed. A new paradigm is upon us where the nation state has mutated into just another form of organization. It will delegate market regulations to continent-wide bodies such as the North American Free Trade Agreement or the European Union. And these in turn will use their economic muscle to undermine each member state. This is why Brussels is pouring money into the north of England. It will be inevitable that nation states are going to fragment. But what's going to happen is the rich areas are going to dump the poor areas. Why should the taxpayers of London support the parasites of Wales? These shakeout trends are going to be interpreted as downsizing, a strategy that is becoming increasingly considered by major, shrewd major corporations these days. And to protect their wealth, rich areas will also undertake right-sizing. This is ensuring a high proportion of wealth-generating knowledge workers to the wealth-depleting service workers. And a delayering policy, getting rid of excessive bureaucracy. See, rich areas have to maintain and expand a critical mass of scientific and technological expertise and use it to underpin an effective education system which will regenerate this human resource. These rich areas are going to reject the liberal attitudes of the present century as the expanding underclass they are spawning and the untrained migrants that they welcomed previously are seen increasingly as economic liabilities. Many too many are born. The state was devised by the superfluous ones. Mass production methods needed an oversupply of humanity. In a sense, the machine age spawned the nation state. But with the demise of the machine age, what is to be done with the glut as we enter the information age? To be successful, a geographical region has to have the intellectual infrastructure to generate its own elite. It has to be an ideal place to do business while remaining a pleasant place to live if it is to entice in the global corporations. Therefore, it needs major cultural and social attractions. It must attract and support art, culture, science, and education. Not for reasons of altruism, not for philanthropy, because it makes hard-headed business sense. London should be pouring money into Covent Garden. However, unquestionably, the first priority for a region is a substantial investment in a center for global communication at the hub of international cable and satellite traffic. But a region also has to be safe for a company and its employees. Consequently, I expect much closer cooperation between local police forces and company security agencies. And the edges between the two groupings are going to become increasingly blurred. Today in the USA, there are nearly twice as many private security guards as there are official police. They make up over 4% of the workforce. The security of the rich is going to be a growth industry in the information age. Perhaps it may be the only growth industry. So if you've got any money, put it into Group 4, no matter what the publicity says. Furthermore, to protect the supportive companies, I expect the states to impose draconian penalties on the perpetrators of economic crimes and those who betray commercial secrecy, along the lines of the Swiss system. So, in conclusion, I have seen the future. Information technology is the vehicle of a new world order, of competition between nations, for this international productive capacity. Now companies must compete in the global market for their wealth-generating services, without which they will drown in a whirlpool of poverty. The world is becoming too sophisticated, and its entrepreneurs far too quick for any manifestation of the collectivist ethic to be practicable. Soon, only a global military state will have the power to stand up to the intellectual and entrepreneurial elite. I have seen the future, and in that future, democratic government won't disappear. It will just become another form of cyber state in cyberspace. Its role is to nurture, propagate, and supply the quality human raw materials. Democratic government, or any other kind of government for that matter, is merely the supplier at the bottom end of the value chain that ultimately supplies wealth. This wealth is not the product of labor, but individual intellect and determination. I have seen the future where automated production has been made possible by technological advances in manufacturing processes. The structured world of semi-skilled labor that arose out of the Industrial Revolution is now disintegrating and taking with it the political ideologies of collectivism. The 20th century will be remembered not as a battle between the collectives of the left and the collectives of the right, but as the domination of the individual by the tribe, and as the control of trade by the ideologies of political collectives. But the 20th century is over. It ended in 1989. I have seen the future. I have seen the coming of new barbarians, transnational enterprises, media barons, criminal conspiracies, financial plutocracies, the new you and the new me. These barbarians care nothing for polite society of the 20th century, for its arbitrary logic, its models and its moralities, its philosophies, its politics, for its affectations of genteel manners and bourgeois sentimentality, for what they would call its degeneracy. The new barbarians are at the gate. Our Rome is burning. The new barbarians know that societal evolution is not benign. Evolution is nature red in tooth and claw. It spawns carnivores as well as herbivores. The carnivorous new barbarians care nothing for democracy or the rules of parliament, which they see as representatives of herbivores. I have seen the future. Grass eaters beware. I can see the jackals circling. I can hear the hyenas laughing. I have seen the future. It's a future born in conflict. A conflict that is mitigated to a certain extent by a predisposition towards human virtues. But these virtues are based on strength, not weakness. I have often laughed at the weaklings who thought themselves good because they had no claws. The winners will have a disposition for confrontation that even welcomes it. One is punished for being weak, not for being cruel. Through conflict, the new barbarians will win to create their new order. Where will you fit in? Will you fit in? I have seen the future. I may not like it. You may not like it. But it works for some. I have seen the future, and it works. It works for the elite cosmopolitan knowledge worker. I have seen the future, and it works. Will it work for you? Thank you.
Speaking for myself, I found that terrifying. If there are any persons in the audience who claim to be qualifiers for the title barbarian knowledge workers, they and only they will be permitted to ask questions of the speaker. And Professor Angel has very kindly said that he will answer questions for a few minutes, and if there are any, perhaps you'd like to address them.
In China today, there are 200 million workers roaming the countryside with no work. 1 billion people are unemployed or underemployed on the face of this planet. We are going to have our fair share. We've survived for two centuries by stealing off the third world. The third world have woken up. We can't steal from them anymore. We have to take our fair share of the trouble. This is why I see the city-state as where the rich will go to secure themselves. You see, the idea that teleworkers are going to live up in the Orkneys and live the ideal life is nonsense. They will get murdered. The teleworkers will come and live in a city-state where they will have a security force to protect them. And this is why I was saying that one of the work groups are going to be security caste, a samurai caste. We've got problems. And if you think the democratic politicians can do anything about it, then you're fooling them. It's only a question of which side you're on and how to deal with the problems as they arise.
When could be another uprising like this
pocket? Could well be, but you see, in the past, the masses were needed for the factories, the masses were needed for the military. Now we have automated factories and less workers. So you don't need masses, you need an elite security force. If you can't be a knowledge worker, go into security. Any of the children, join the army, the police force. That's going to be a big future.
Yes, at the back.
It isn't enough to go around. Only if you have the knowledge. If you're just a service worker, you don't want to know, because you are a liability, because ultimately you are a strain on the economy.
And that's why countries won't accept that unless we are really specialized in secretary of knowledge, which we don't have. And this is one of the
Yes, I predict the future by predicting the present. All I'm doing is looking at today and trying to find a new paradigm to analyze and describe it.
Yes, at the back there.
Whenever there's a major transition, when we move from the agriculture to the industrial, when we move into the agricultural revolution itself, there's always been large groups of people wandering the countryside. The figures now are astronomical, but in the past, in the industrial revolution, there were bands of unemployed vagrants. We are going to see a new set of poor laws, the new Criminal Justice Act. Is a reinvention of the poor laws. The idea is that with the original poor laws, if you were a vagrant, able-bodied vagrant, you could spend one night inside the city. After one night, you stayed any longer and you were caught and they flogged you. If you were caught and you had the marks of a flogging, they cut a notch in your ear. If they caught you in a notch in your ear, they carved a V in your forehead. And if you had a V in your forehead, I hate to think what they did. So the new Criminal Justice Act is just the first step on developing a new poor law, because ultimately politicians know that their salaries are paid by taxpayers. They're not going to support non-taxpayers.
Yes, there's somebody there.
If the dependent immobile service workers are poor, who will purchase the products that the knowledge workers produce?
this is wonderful. The people who make this argument are the ones who deny supply-side economics. This is supply-side sociology. You have masses of workers, masses of people, and the very mass itself will generate something. See? That may have worked in the past. We are now entering a new paradigm. I'm not telling you what's going to happen. I'm just saying that the institutions of the past are going to break down. Because what's happened is the values of the past are no longer perceived as values today. And when the values change, institutions that are based on the old set of values are finished. And the new set of institutions are not predictable. They will come out in a natural selection. That's why I stress this idea of mutation and natural selection. Because different areas will experiment with different procedures. And the ones that are successful will be copied. The ones that fail will just die out. And so I picked on the example of Singapore. That model is being copied all around the world.
Yes, at the back, the top. You, yes, yes.
Do you expect the population of the world to increase?
Definitely.
Peasants will perish.
Yep.
Yes.
Are you saying the barbarians have got no social conscience? If so, why?
They have a different conscience, a different morality. The idea that our morality is somehow an absolute definition of goodness is extremely naive. And the new barbarians have a different set of values. In the medieval times, the knights had a sense of honor. They would behave very well to fellow knights, but they thought nothing of rape and pillage among the peasants. But they didn't see themselves as bad. It's a different form of morality. And we're going to see a different form of morality emerging.
So why do you think?
Because the present morality cannot survive. Because the economic pressures, the social pressures, the population pressures are such that the information age has pulled the plug on it all. It's now collapsing, it's imploding. Idea of progress, this utopianism that is so typical of socialism, that there's actually some brave new world, some new Jerusalem, some Judeo-Christian heaven where the lion will lie down with the lamb. We know it's over. The future is brutality. And what we have to do is to decide where we stand.
And I suppose you would say that Noah was quite happy with the flood, actually. Yeah, well, he was, wasn't he?
Well, there weren't that many people around, of course. There were plenty of wide open spaces.
Do you have any Welsh Methodist
Christians? Susceptible of a yes or no answer. You can say yes or no.
Let's just say I've lost the religion, but I've kept the bigotry.
Yes, at the back.
What I'm saying is these pressures are out there. I'm pretending that they're not. is naivety in the extreme. The idea, the whole concept of development, of developing countries, is a lie. You know, the future is more likely to be India with institutionalized poverty than some view of Western democracy where the workers who basically turn up are totally overpaid for what they do. So we've got enormous pressures that we're not going to be able to sustain. So what I've described are the forces leading to the downfall. How we get out of it, if we get out of it, will be the result of natural selection, as Trotsky said, the natural selection of accidents. Whether we will get out of it has yet to be seen.
Yes, gentlemen.
There are always jokers in the practical cards. We now see a bizarre development almost, say, in societies withdrawing themselves altogether from this and setting up barriers, like Islamic fundamentalism. Would you comment on that?
Well, there will be lots of experiments, and people will try different ways of dealing with it. But if you want to take part in the global economy, that is an extremely naive position. It's the Aryan position of Nazi Germany. The idea was to get a boundary around it and live solely inside it, with only the racial elite in there. But the global economy is such that any society that defines itself in terms of ethnic purity is doomed, because they do not have access to global markets. Anyone who thinks that way, it's economic suicide. To me, the city-state is the entity that is likely to survive, but a cosmopolitan city-state. No. Any city is cosmopolitan, always was, always will be. And particularly now, London, for example, at the end of empire. Every capital city at the end of empire, New York, Moscow, London, are cosmopolitan. They have enormous potential. Basically, within the M25, you can find someone who is related to every rich businessman in the world. You have access to every market in the world. What we've got to do is to use that new technology to make sure we can make the most of that market.
One more question. Yes, sir.
If we bring up our children to that philosophy, it was utterly a barbarian if you want anything about you, or put on uniform, can we be surprised that the rate of crime increases?
No.
Maybe one more question.
Well, we are going to find all the old structures, the whole nature of jobs is going to change. What does it mean to work? See, the idea of what we think of as work today is not what they thought of as work 300 years ago. And so the whole nature of employment and what it means is changing. Added to the fact that we've created two generations of people who actually are fitted into a system that is now failing. The idea that, you know, you can somehow train them in new technology, whatever that means, so that suddenly they walk into jobs when we don't even know what jobs are, is naive. We are going to find that the whole system is going to be in flux after two generations before it settles down. It always takes 50 years to settle down. So all I'm doing is imposing on the present change what's happened in the last two or three major shifts in paradigm.
Well, yes, of course, please do. I'm sorry.
One point, those of you who don't like what I'm saying, take comfort in Professor Epstein, a virologist from Oxford. We were on a platform at a UNESCO conference, and I did my tirade, and he stood up and said, Professor Angel is wrong. His vision of the future will not happen. The viruses will kill us all well within 10 years.
Professor Angel, on behalf of all of us, may I say how absolutely stimulating this is. Shocking but stimulating. And really absolutely fascinating. And we can all say that we were here and heard it from you first. And Mrs. Redwood and Portillo, they don't even know the meaning of the expression right wing. But thank you very much indeed. It's been absolutely fascinating.